Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is making the rounds in Western Europe, asking leaders for more weapons. So far, he's getting the goods, but France, Germany, and the UK are expecting results.
Ukraine will need to show that now that they have all this military hardware, that they also have the tactical acumen to use it.
Also today, fewer migrants are arriving at the border this week as Title 42 gets replaced by some new deterrence policies. One expert says it won't last.
People who are arriving because they're forced to move.
Plus, a sit-down with one of the world's most notorious online hackers.
If I was to have met Bastard under different conditions, let's say at a bar, I can have a drink and talk to him, and he seems like a regular, personable type of guy.
The man behind Bastard Lord, all that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It has been a busy few days on the road for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. On Saturday, he was welcomed in Rome by Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. The next morning in Germany for a meeting with Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Sunday afternoon, Zelensky was off to Paris on a visit with President Emmanuel Macron. On Monday, no band, no crowds, but a helicopter ride took Ukraine's president to British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's country estate. Zelensky has been seeking more military support, and the response was overwhelmingly positive. Jacob Kierkegaard was watching all of this from Brussels. He's a senior fellow there with the German Marshall Fund. Jacob, how would you describe the response from Western leaders?
Well, I think, as you just said, it's been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, I would basically say that the Western European leaders are, if you like, doubling down, certainly committing to Ukrainian military victory. And I was also struck by this big commitment of weapons together with, you know, an unambiguous European commitment to international borders from 1991, the Ukrainian peace formula, which basically means, you know, Crimea, etc., all of Ukraine's territory goes back to Ukraine.
Right. And that's what Zelensky has said he wants. What does the size of these military aid packages say, though, about Western support for Zelensky's effort to drive Russia out of Ukraine?
My view is that Ukraine now, from what we hear, they will have trained an additional 9 mechanized / armored brigades. These brigades will now, of course, be even better equipped. They will also, now that both the UK and France have committed medium range, 300 kilometers or so cruise missiles, they will have better capabilities to strike the Russian rear. So not only will they be militarily successful, in my opinion, over the course of the late spring and summer, but they will also, hopefully, in my opinion, achieve the goal that Vladimir Zelensky also said, namely to be successful militarily without sacrificing too many Ukrainian soldiers' lives in the process.
This spring offensive, whenever that begins, will presumably show Western leaders what Ukraine can do with their weapon systems. Is it fair to see that as a bellwether when it comes of Ukraine's chances of ultimately defeating Russia?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is, if not, you know, the sort of make or break, you know, offensive, but it's certainly one in which Ukraine will need to show that now that they have all this military hardware, that they also have the tactical acumen to use it. Combined arms operations, they will need to show that, you know, some of these, I would argue, very innovative tactics that they have shown with drone adjusted artillery observations and other things, that they're basically able to utilize this against the Russian army that to date, I would say, have proven itself utterly incapable of adapting much to this new fully monitored, high-tech, integrated drone surveillance battlefield.
One could speculate that the next big ask would be fighter jets. Ukraine has this history of requesting weapon systems, being refused, and then eventually getting the missiles and tanks they want. What are Zelensky's prospects for getting fighter jets?
Last week proved that they have vastly improved. There was no firm commitment of F-16s, but there were commitment by the UK, France, and according to both Sunak and Macron, quote-unquote, other NATO countries, to begin training Ukrainian pilots on Western airplanes. And those airplanes presumably are a combination of F-16s and quite possibly some of the French fighter jets as well.
The question then always becomes, Jacob, is that going to be seen as a serious escalation by Russia? And does Putin have what Russia needs to meet that escalation in the air?
I think it is possible that this will be seen as a significant escalation by Russia, but it's not really clear what Russia has, you know, in the tank to do about that. We have seen as late as yesterday that they launched a very significant cruise missile and other with basically Kinshal and other the most allegedly most advanced Russian missiles against Kyiv. And every one of them was shot down by Ukraine's Patriot and other air defense system. So it's just not clear to me that Russia really has many ways of escalating conventionally.
Now, when President Zelensky was in Italy, he spoke with Pope Francis. The Vatican, like China, has offered to mediate between Moscow and Kyiv. What did Zelensky say to the Pope this time around?
He basically told the Pope what the Pope needs to hear, that it is meaningless to not make a distinction between the aggressor and the victim, which is basically what the Pope and others are saying. Or there's some sort of equality between Russia and Ukraine and that they both need to seek peace. I think that's a ludicrous and amoral stance that basically forgets that it's Russia that attacked Ukraine.
What happens, though, Jacob, if the spring offensive is a flop? If Ukraine's war with Russia drags on and on, I mean, there could be a loss of enthusiasm in the West. What do you see then as Zelensky's options?
Well, I mean, in that scenario, clearly, you know, Zelensky will have another, like, PR challenge. He's going to have to convince Western leaders to maintain the level of military support that we have now reached, that they're going to have to own up to their rhetorical commitments of standing by Ukraine for, quote unquote, as long as it takes. Well, if it turns out to take a lot longer, that obviously means that Western leaders are going to have to ask their taxpayers to cough up more support, more money, more weapons, etc., to help Ukraine ultimately prevail. But there's no doubt that, you know, in the sort of real world, that will become more difficult.
Jacob Kierkegaard is a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund, speaking with us from Brussels, briefing us on Volodymyr Zelensky's options for war and peace as they currently exist. Jacob, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It was expected to be a chaotic weekend at the U.S. southern border. The Biden administration was preparing for up to 13,000 migrants arriving every day. But the last few days have been relatively quiet. Here's the update from U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas.
The United States Border Patrol has experienced a 50% drop in the number of encounters versus what we were experiencing before Title 42 ended at midnight on Thursday.
Title 42 had been the pandemic-era restriction for asylum seekers. Now U.S. policies at the border have reverted to what they were before COVID hit, with some significant differences. The World's TB's Isaiah explains.
There are still tens of thousands of people waiting in northern Mexico for a chance to enter the United States. More keep arriving every day. They have fled violence, poverty, and political instability all over the Western Hemisphere. But many have been hesitant to seek U.S. asylum in the past few days because of this frequent message from Secretary Mayorkas.
There's a consequence if one does not use lawful pathways. And that consequence is removal from the United States, a deportation, and a five-year ban on reentry and possible criminal prosecution.
Those lawful pathways to asylum here in this country begin with a smartphone app called CBP1. That's how asylum seekers in Mexico are supposed to book an appointment with U.S. immigration officials. But here is one problem. Many migrants who arrive in Mexico don't have a smartphone. But in addition to that, the app doesn't work well. It frequently freezes, and sometimes it fails to take the required profile picture of the applicant, or it sets up an appointment for a location hundreds of miles away.
Aside from glitches and functionality problems with the app,
There's a very limited number of appointments available per day.
That's Stephanie Brewer with the Washington Office on Latin America. She says there are only 1,000 appointments available every day, and they fill up in a matter of minutes. The Biden administration also has put in place a new rule called the asylum transit ban. It requires that migrants apply for asylum in a third country before they are eligible to do so here in the U.S., and they need to show that they have been denied in that country. Brewer says this doesn't make a lot of sense for many asylum seekers.
Because for many people, seeking asylum in another country, such as Mexico, for example, isn't a logical option. They may not feel safe there.
She says a lot of people have support networks and relatives in the United States with jobs lined up for them. But in a country like Mexico or Colombia, she says they probably have no connections. And in any case, being granted asylum is no easy task, according to Julio Rank of the International Rescue Committee. He says people need to prove they face persecution or are victims of serious human rights violations in their home country.
Unfortunately, this is a system that makes it very complicated for those fleeing the three main drivers of migration and displacement, which are chronic violence, climate change, and the economic downfalls of COVID-19 that many countries are still experiencing.
He says poverty or violence are not reasons to be granted asylum. It's not clear whether all these challenges will discourage people from seeking asylum in the United States. As for the drop in arrivals at the border in recent days, Stephanie Brewer says it won't last long.
We've seen over and over that policies focused around deterrence and detention do not work. They do cause cyclical fluctuations, but ultimately, people who are arriving because they're forced to move.
She says the rules might have changed, but what hasn't changed are the reasons why people flee their homes and look to resettle in a place like the U.S. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
You've heard about extreme sports. How about extreme cooking? Nigerian chef Hilda Bassi has loved cooking ever since she was a little kid. But over the past few days, she's shown the world just how deep that love really is. Bassi started cooking last Thursday in Lagos, Nigeria, and she didn't stop for days. It was her attempt to break the Guinness World Record for the longest cooking marathon by a single person and get past India's Lata Tandon, who was holding the record of 87 hours and 45 minutes of nonstop cooking. 27-year-old Bassi told a local TV station in Lagos that she wanted to beat that record to highlight Nigeria's cuisine and break barriers for young women in Africa.
If I'm being honest, like girls that look like me, there's always like a certain kind of perception. People tend to underestimate like what we're capable of.
Throughout the cookathon, Bassi had a ton of support.
Love you, girl. Love you. You're doing it. You got this. You got this.
In the Lagos neighborhood of Lekki, where Bassi has her kitchen, crowds of people started camping outside, partying and cheering her on as they watched her cook on closed-circuit TV. She was also followed globally. According to Bassi's Instagram, over 1 million people watched the live stream. Even politicians and celebrities tuned in. When the cooking timer ticked over to 100 hours, the fans went wild. Fireworks even lit up the sky. Bassi called it quits shortly after and went home for some well-deserved rest. I mean, it was like a championship bout in her kitchen. Bassi was getting her brow wiped down, was allowed a 5-minute break each hour where she'd get a foot massage. She ended up preparing dozens of different recipes, including that West African classic, jollof rice. The Guinness World Record says it's aware of the chef's amazing attempt to enter the history books and is now reviewing the evidence before making it official. The problem of trash and how to salvage useful items from it, that rests in the hands of some of the lowest paid workers on the planet. Just ahead on the show, looking out for the health and safety of waste pickers. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Here in the United States, we have robust recycling systems, even though many are not perfect. In many parts of the world, the only real recycling schemes are the ones that rely on so-called waste pickers, people who make a living sorting through garbage. It's a critical role. The pickers are removing waste that might otherwise end up in incinerators or dumped in the ocean. Not only is it a tough way to earn a living, waste pickers are also exposed to toxic chemicals and are vulnerable to exploitation. We wanted to know more about the lives of these people, so today we're hearing the first in a series of stories from across the globe. From Ghana, reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman takes us to one of the country's largest landfills, just outside the capital, Accra.
As the sun rises over the sprawling Pune landfill, the air is thick with a pungent smell of dust and decaying garbage. Here, mountains of trash stretch as far as the eye can see. Scores of waste pickers scavenge through heaps of rubbish for recyclable materials. They appear to be undeterred by the overwhelming stench and the grime. 36-year-old Johnson Doe is dressed in green overalls with a white helmet to match, his usual attire when he comes to work.
When growing up, I wanted to be a military pilot, but you know, life happens.
Doe says he started working in the landfill 20 years ago. His best option for making a living to take care of his wife, two children and his parents.
Many people think the mentally ill people are people who work at the dump site. So that is how they see us, like we are illiterate. Some people even call us criminals.
He collects items such as plastic bottles, aluminium cans and scrap metal. Then he sells them to recycling companies who buy them by weight. The prices he gets for the materials depend on the market demand, but on average he might make $13 in a day.
The middlemen or the companies also, they give the kind of price they like to our materials. So they determine the price that they will give us. It's a kind of exploitation or it's kind of looking down on us.
But the abuse and exploitation are the least of the worries of waste pickers here. As Doe takes me around the landfill, the scene gets horrifying. He shows me piles of medical waste scattered throughout the landfill.
So look at the dangers we are exposed to every day. See the syringes, see the blood, see the pins and other things coming from the hospital.
He says this medical waste puts them at risk of injury and infectious diseases such as HIV and hepatitis B and C. And even as he points to the improperly disposed medical waste, I can see a lot of his colleagues sifting through the garbage with their bare hands, worn-out gloves and without face coverings. Some have no protective gear at all. Doe recounts the story of a colleague who, while sorting through a pile, punctured a plastic bag.
It was an acid, and the acid splashed on her, all over her body. And at once we saw all the clothes on her was burning.
And even in situations like this, when they try to seek medical treatment in hospitals, Doe says they face stigma from health workers who describe them as dirty and refuse to attend to them.
People look down upon us to the extent that we don't receive proper treatment when the need arises or when we are in a situation like emergencies. And every day we encounter emergencies.
Waste pickers also do not have access to clean water, hand washing facilities or sanitation facilities. Grace Avamaga says it's difficult to practice good hygiene.
Young man, you have period now.
There are no washrooms here to change your sanitary towel during that time of the month. Even if we get a wooden shack here as washroom, we will appreciate it.
There are about 1,000 people at this landfill, but across the country, it's hard to get an exact count because they are mostly not organized. Solomon Noy is head of waste management at the Accra Metropolitan Assembly. He's done a number of studies into how medical and industrial waste endanger waste pickers. He says a lot of industries are channeling harmful substances to landfills.
Apart from the harmful gases they will be inhaling, their skin will be exposed to certain corrosive and carcinogenic elements within the waste that they are scavenging.
Medical waste expert at the Accra School of Hygiene, Michael Afodapa, says the neglect of waste pickers is unacceptable if Ghana is serious about securing the environment and building a healthier population. He says proper sorting and treatment of waste before it reaches the landfill, coupled with the provision of personal protective items, is crucial.
Because when we safely separate the waste, we are not only protecting these people, we are protecting the community. Because before the waste gets there, it is treated. And that can reduce the risk of infections, for that matter, all forms of hazards that may come from this.
Officials at Ghana's Health Facilities Regulatory Agency, the institution mandated to see to this, say they are alarmed by the rate at which untreated medical waste are being dumped at the Pune landfill site. Head of Operations Ajiman Bedu says it's been challenging prosecuting non-complying hospitals.
It's just quite recent that as an agency we were given a lawyer. Prior to that, we didn't have any attorney to make sure that the enforcement bites. And no regulator can work best without enforcement.
Christy Adiola Braham works with the Global Action Network, Women in Informal Employment, Globalizing and Organizing. Her organization has been pushing for better conditions for waste pickers around the world.
So we're seeing that waste pickers being driven into debt, needing to sell their belongings, sell land, take out loans just to afford a single visit to the doctor. And so this is why it's so important for us to advocate for universal healthcare so that everybody has access to affordable, appropriate and high quality health services.
But beyond universal healthcare, Solomon Noy wants a change in policy in Ghana.
We should have a sanitation master plan, and there should be effective and efficient bylaws that will compel particular industries to treat their wastes and render them non-harmful.
Back at the Pune landfill, Doe agrees, but says in addition to new policies, the government must recognize the work of waste pickers in the recycling process and make conditions more favorable so that they too can earn a decent living while contributing to the economy. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
This story was produced with the support of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Tomorrow we go to India, among the planet's biggest producers and consumers of plastic. We'll look at how waste pickers there play a key role in preventing plastic bottles and packaging from ending up in India's rivers and oceans. You're with the world. In southern Mexico, droughts are getting worse. That's forcing farmers to adjust and adapt. On one farm, they've ripped up the conventional playbook.
La intención de crear un espacio así es como poder...
This farmer says it's about creating a space where there's another way of doing things, like duplicating the diverse ecology of forests on cropland. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Gradually, Syria is getting reaccepted by the Community of Nations. Last week, it rejoined the Arab League. Yesterday, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad was invited to attend the UN's annual climate conference later this year. It is a stunning turnaround for Assad after more than a decade of war in Syria, in which he regularly bombed his own citizens. Assad is betting that his turnaround will also improve Syria's fortunes. Karam Shah is a political economist focused on Syria and a senior fellow with the New Lines Institute. He joins us from the UK. Karam, the Arab League and its members restored full relations with Syria. They seem to get the normalized Syria ball rolling. Remind us why they did it.
So for them, the main motivation initially when they were engaging with Syria was to arrive at a political settlement to the conflict and to limit Iran's influence in the country. Those were their main two motivations. However, recently, the only thing that remained for these countries to address in Syria, well, any factor of significance, is actually a new factor, which is the emergence of narcotics, mainly an amphetamine-type drug that's sweeping the region.
Right, Captagon, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, there are still pockets of conflict in Syria. How can Syria's government use this normalization of relations to quickly improve its economy or improve it at all? How do you see that working?
To the Assad regime, the main priority is to survive politically and to regain control over the rest of the country. But I think what they're being offered could stimulate the economy, but that will be in exchange of depriving the regime from another significant stream of revenue, which is the revenue from narcotics. And here we're talking billions of dollars. So the countries trying to normalize with the Assad regime have started to float the idea that they're willing to pay money into to help Syria in exchange for stopping the flow of narcotics, and that's primarily Captagon. So I would say most of the discussion as we speak now is about narcotics.
What about economic development, though, in Syria? Is there an expectation now with the acceptance by the Arab League of Syria that maybe there's heavy investment coming from Gulf countries like the UAE or Saudi Arabia?
This is certainly the expectation. However, whether that's going to be investment or another form of economic aid is still to be determined. We're starting to hear that some Arab states, primarily the ones targeted by Captagon, would be actually putting money into the UN instead of investing directly in the country. And that helps them in a way to deal with Western sanctions on Syria, because these sanctions are unilateral. Then Gulf states do not have to be exposed to them if they donate the money through the UN, because the United Nations does not adhere to unilateral sanctions.
Just to clarify, the UN spends money on humanitarian responses, things like that, which is really different from business investment, correct?
Well, in principle, that's what the UN should be doing. However, there is a category of business or humanitarian response called early recovery. And early recovery is not well defined. So for if you take a relaxed definition, you can claim that it's reconstruction. If you take a conservative definition, you say, no, not really. It's basically us allowing people help themselves instead of relying on humanitarian aid forever that meets their basic needs. So I think that is one of the loopholes that can be exploited by the United Nations to spend donor money in Syria. And that early recovery might start to mean rehabilitating schools, fixing infrastructure, and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, there is no agreed definition to it, so they can abuse that fact.
I mean, wouldn't this make Western sanctions kind of meaningless, or at least weaken them?
In a sense, yes. And this is a workaround for sanctions. Now, whether actually that will eventually happen altogether, I think is yet to be seen, especially with this forthcoming vote in Congress on a bill that makes normalizing with the Assad regime extremely costly. I think we'll find out soon whether Gulf states will go and take serious steps towards normalization with the Assad regime in light of this forthcoming law in the U.S.
Karam Shar is a political economist focused on Syria and a senior fellow with the New Lines Institute. Karam, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
In the world of cyber hackers, the name Basterlord is well known. He's a 27-year-old former graphic artist in Ukraine. Basterlord started small, spamming was his thing at first. Then he worked his way up through the ranks to become a key figure in some of the world's most infamous cyber criminal gangs, all while living in a war-torn region of Russian-occupied Ukraine. His story made Dina Temple-Raston, host of the Click Here podcast, really want to meet him.
We're calling him Ivan, but people online know him as Basterlord. He lives in the Donbas region of Ukraine, which is occupied by Russia, and he spoke to us through an interpreter. He's at the center of a new report from John DiMaggio, the senior researcher at a Virginia-based cybersecurity firm called Analyst One. And DiMaggio put us in touch with Basterlord, a rare chance to have a candid conversation directly with one of the world's most infamous hackers.
Is this your first podcast?
The.
Yes.
So let me just try and understand. Do you see yourself as a hacker? How do we describe you?
Let's put it this way. I'm extortionist, retired.
Retired extortionist, okay. And he said his story was a complicated one. And while we were able to confirm much of what he told us, we couldn't independently confirm all of it. But what's undeniable is that Basterlord has quite a hacker resume. He's a kind of Zelig of hackers. He started with a major Russian cybercrime gang called Reval, but has since made the rounds in the cybercriminal world. The cybersecurity researchers who track him say Basterlord cut his teeth on phishing attacks, learning to craft emails that have malware hidden inside. Basterlord somehow knows just what to write to get someone to click on it, even though a little voice in their heads is telling them they probably shouldn't. If you ask Basterlord to describe his specialty, he says he sells access.
I would actually describe myself as searcher for access or access broker.
John DiMaggio of Analyst One says in the hierarchy of the hacker world, access brokers are a key part of the cybercrime business model.
There's a whole other larger part of that population that you don't read about every day, that don't necessarily have the ability to successfully and easily compromise, you know, a Fortune 500 company or a company that's going to have a lot of money to pay.
So DiMaggio said, cyber criminals turn to people like Basterlord.
One of the ways to get around that is just buying the access.
In other words, he does the breaking in and then holds the door open for customers so they can do what they will once they're inside. But Basterlord didn't just want to have the spoils all to himself, which is why he became the talk of dark web forums recently. He put together a 2-volume manual that people who've seen it tell us could teach just about anyone to launch a ransomware attack. No prior experience required.
I already knew he had trained people, and from seeing conversations that he's been in and people talking about their account of working with him. And one of the things that seemed really interesting to me was that he seemed to sort of enjoy giving back to that community because someone once helped him and he wanted to sort of return that favor and help upcoming criminals.
DiMaggio said Basterlord wanted to create a community of young hackers that he could say he'd help not just nurture, but bring along. The creation of a manual was a tangible way of doing that.
And when he put the first ransom manual out there, you know, that was how he was making money. He was giving the manual and tools away for free.
The manual and tools to launch a ransomware attack once you're in someone's network. If you couldn't hack into a network on your own, well, he could help you there too, but for a price. He'd charge a fee to let you into a network he'd already compromised.
Because most people buying it wouldn't have the skill to just go hack into a target environment. And he's giving you an environment he already has access to so you can learn.
Basterlord put out a second volume more than a year later, in December of 2022. But this time, John said, Basterlord had adopted a completely different monetization strategy. He offered to sell a limited number of copies for $10,000 each. He said that when the volume sold out, he would stop distribution, so all its secrets would only be known and used by a select few. It was like he was selling a numbered print of something he thought was really rare. And just as it seemed like he was an artist at the top of his game, abruptly, he made an announcement no one expected. He said he was retiring. He didn't say why he'd had enough, but it might have been because he started getting, for a hacker at least, the wrong kind of attention. From people like this guy, Juan Ignacio Nicolosi.
He made mistakes in OPSEC that allowed us to hunt him and find him and eventually get him to retirement.
So are you kind of hanging around in dark web forums all the time?
24/7.
That is a lot of time. He's an investigator at ProDaft, a Swiss cyber threat intelligence company. And he's been tracking Basterlord since July 2020 because ProDaft doesn't just protect people from cyber attacks. They actually hunt the people who are behind them.
Let's put it this way. We're not afraid of the malware. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
He saw Basterlord, a guy who was very good about being bad, weaponizing his knowledge. So Juan and his team actually got their hands on a copy of the manual. And though we asked, they wouldn't say exactly how they did that.
We gave visibility to a server. We didn't buy it. We don't give money to criminals.
Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. So is it right to characterize this as sort of hacking back? You broke into their server?
We gave visibility.
What does that mean?
It means we gain visibility that we're able to look inside.
And then they told everyone about it. In fact, they announced they had it on social media. And one said they did that not only to advertise it, but to actually shut it down. Among other things, the manual pointed to holes in specific networks. And if the manual was shared, either publicly or with the people who ran the networks Bastard Lord had targeted, then those vulnerabilities he had found to break in would get patched, and the manual would be worthless. This was, of course, a huge blow to Bastard Lord's business. But then he started to worry about something even worse. He feared ProDaft would also reveal his identity, which might get him arrested.
So he had told a researcher that we talked to that he thought you guys were trying to dox him. Are you? Why does that get a laugh?
Yeah, we're not doxing him. We're hunting him. That's two different things.
Soon after ProDaft said they had secured the manual, Bastard Lord announced he was retiring. And while it might seem like cause and effect, Bastard Lord told us there was a lot more to it.
My psychological condition substantially deteriorated lately.
By his own account, the unraveling began with a very disturbing phone call.
From high-ranking FSB official who requested that I showed for interrogation.
The FSB is the intelligence arm of Russia, and just before the interrogation request, the Russian authorities had rounded up lower-level members of Rival, that ransomware group we talked about before. Bastard Lord thought the call might be about that.
That, to some extent, caused some panic in me, but as it turned out...
As it turned out, the call had nothing to do with hacking, but it got him thinking about quitting while he was ahead.
So it was piling up as a snowball, and at that point I was actually being treated by medical remedies from panic attacks. So in order to successfully complete this, I needed to wrap this whole thing up.
He said his goal had been to earn $1 million, and while he didn't quite get there because, among other things...
I'd say I lost about $300,000 by investing in cryptocurrency.
And he said he now has a hacking crew that's pretty self-sufficient, and he doesn't need to be on the cyber front lines anymore. So he and the crew made an agreement. Since he taught them what they know, they'll give him a 20% cut of everything they make from now on. He doesn't have to be involved.
Let's put it this way. I completely distanced myself from this business and I'm making a passive percentage.
Got it. Okay. So if you're trying to explain to people why you did all this, how do you explain it?
I'm from a poor family, and that was a great opportunity to earn some money. It was just a financial opportunity. There's nothing else behind it.
Do you feel guilty about it?
No, not really. For the companies that were paying me enough money to cover their expenses, what I'm making is just pennies for them.
So because it was companies and not people, you think it's not as bad?
I think more yes than no. I think this company has enough money to pay all the expenses. And I think people who work for them do not really suffer a lot.
The thing about Bastard Lord's retirement is that no one we talk to in the cybersecurity world believes him. No one thinks Bastard Lord is actually going to retire to a dacha in Russia and work on his hobbies. Juan said that doesn't fit the profile.
We prefer to think he's preparing or just changing names. We don't think he's retiring. We just think it's a good post in order to move himself to the other side and try to reform his entire operation.
John DiMaggio doesn't think he'll exit stage left either. Though I did ask him whether Bastard Lord's mentoring and manual writing make him a different breed of cyber criminal.
Does this make him a kinder, gentler hacker?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I would use the words kinder or gentler, but more relatable. And if I was to have met Bastard Lord in different conditions, let's say at a bar, I can have a drink and talk to him, and he seems like a regular, personable type of guy. At the same time, he does harm people, and he does harm companies, and he does, you know, these malicious attacks do have an effect on people, their lives, their retirement, their getting food on the table. It does have an effect. So I do 100% know that he knows the difference between right and wrong, but he has chosen to keep doing it.
For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the Click Here podcast about all things cyber and intelligence. The story was produced by Will Jarvis and Sean Powers. Adaptation. It's a word we hear a lot when discussing climate change, the need and ability to alter our ways of doing things as the climate shifts. For many farmers in Mexico, adaptation is already a very real practice. It's also the focus of this installment of The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
In the Mexican state of Oaxaca, farmers are practicing sustainable, regenerative agriculture. The idea is to make their fields more drought-resistant. Reporter Michael Fox takes us to one farm in Oaxaca, a place that's emblematic of a trend across the globe.
22-year-old farmer Orlando Sanchez Bernardino pulls weeds from a bed of garlic. They're almost ready to harvest. Lush green stalks rise a foot or two off the ground. But there's something extra special about this bed of plants. Alongside it is a winding row of luscious garbanzo plants. They're moist to the touch, but they haven't been watered in weeks.
Aparte de que el ajo es una planta que requiere mucha agua.
The garlic is a plant that requires a lot of water, says Sanchez Bernardino. The garbanzo beans don't. So practically, the garbanzo beans are just growing off the humidity from watering the garlic plants beside them, he says. Sanchez Bernardino is a farmer at Tierra del Sol, or Land of the Sun, an organic farm in the central valley of Oaxaca, Mexico. It's an oasis of green in a parched brown landscape where it hasn't rained for 5 months. Down a dirt path, Luis Lopez Sanchez is clearing soil for new rows of plants. He wears a red long-sleeve shirt and a Panama hat.
Esta es la zanahoria. Aquí viene la zanahoria.
Over here we have carrots, he says, pushing some of the stalks out of the way. Cilantro, broccoli, and radishes. Four types of vegetables in this group, he says.
Como hay variación y diversidad.
Since you have variation and diversity, you have less diseases, he says. Plus, instead of competing with each other, they actually cooperate. What the broccoli gives back into the soil helps the carrots. What the carrots give back helps the broccoli, and so on, he says. That's not the way it works in monocropping. There, they all suck up the same nutrients. These are just a few of the innovative strategies being implemented at Tierra del Sol in order to weather the shifting climate. The plant beds are covered in mulch made from the leaves of the banana plants and other trees running alongside the vegetables. The whole farm is laid out according to the natural contours of the landscape in order to maximize the full impact of the water when it rains or when they irrigate. Founder Pablo Ruiz Lavalle says he got the idea to start this farm in the late 1990s after working as an airline pilot for decades and watching the Mexican landscape transform, becoming drier and drier.
Y entonces el... La intención de crear un espacio así es como poder...
The idea is to create a space where we can say, hey, there's another way to do things, he says. It doesn't have to be that model of monocropping agriculture. On Wednesdays, members of the farm deliver orders of organic produce to community residents.
You don't need to take another...
On the weekends, they give tours. Tierra del Sol adheres to a style of farming called syntropic. It's a type of regenerative agriculture that's gained traction in alternative farming circles over the last decade. The idea is to recreate the symmetry or order found naturally in forests, where plants coexist and feed off the surrounding ecosystem. It was founded by Ernst Gosch. a Swiss farmer who's lived and farmed in Brazil for the last 40 years. That's him speaking about farming techniques in a video posted online a few years ago. Roche has been internationally known for this style of regenerative farming. When he acquired his 1,200-acre farm in Brazil in the 1980s, it was degraded pasture land. Today, it's lush jungle that produces quality cacao, among many other things. He says it's even raining more. Namaste Messerschmidt is a Brazilian expert in regenerative and syntropic farming who's worked with Gauche. He's also traveled to Tierra del Sol to facilitate workshops, and he says this style of farming is not really new. This is a revival of ancestral agriculture, Latin American agriculture, and indigenous agriculture that deeply integrates natural processes, he says. But it is labor-intensive, and it has to compete with the industrialized mainstream farms of monocrops that cover the Oaxacan valleys and vast regions of the planet. Those require constant pesticides, fertilizers, and heavy machinery, which degrades once nutrient-rich topsoil. The UN Food and Agriculture Agency recently warned that 90% of the world's topsoil will be at risk by 2050. But experts say cutting-edge sustainable farming, like regenerative agriculture, can help weather the storm or the drought by rebuilding forests and ecosystems, sucking carbon out of the atmosphere, and creating reservoirs of moisture in once-degraded landscapes. Ryan Zinn is regenerative projects manager at Dr. Bronner's Soap Company, which has its own regenerative standards and sources from both organic and regenerative producers.
What we've seen both in the literature and in anecdotal examples is that farms that really practice regenerative organic agriculture are not only more resilient in times of stress, but they actually can produce more food or more production in general under normal conditions.
Zinn says likely millions of people are already farming regeneratively across the planet, and the industry is growing. Regenerative agriculture is expected to be worth $17 billion U.S. dollars by 2027. Those in the field say this is the future of farming if the planet is to weather the climate crisis. But as those at Tierra del Sol know well, for now, regenerative agriculture is still on the fringe, and there is a long way to go. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Closing today with the cycle of life, to be born, to live, to die. It's a literal translation from Portuguese of a song, Nascer, Viver, Morrer. This is new music from Brazilian musician Tim Bernardes. Bernardes has worked with Brazilian stars like Caetano Veloso, Tom Zay, and the late Gal Costa. If you're on the West Coast, Bernardes is playing tonight in San Francisco and tomorrow in L.A. before heading to Europe to share his unique sound there.
Eu quero, eu amo, eu posso, eu vou viver na realidade que é onde é possível.
Tim Bernardes takes us out today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Thank you for listening, and come back again tomorrow.
Às vezes na barra, às vezes na boa, no mundo, na mente, no sonho e no ser. No raro momento infinito viver. Morrer, que ausência é a presença do inexistente. Do silêncio com seu volume gigante.